Welcome to The Property Planet, a podcast with Simon Howley and Amanda Perrotten of Bell Howley Perrotten, the show all about the tax and legal issues surrounding property ownership, where we discuss everything that affects property investors and developers and go deep into the details to unravel the advice, highlight the traps you can fall into, and dispel the myths surrounding property ownership in the UK.
Morning, Amanda.
Good morning, Simon. How are you?
Very well. How's the weather in the UK?
It's going to pick up for the next couple of days, and then it's typically going to rain all weekend, I think. So that'll be nice.
Excellent.
I want to know what it's like where you are.
A little bit too hot today, but mustn't complain. There you go. So we have another guest from Field Court Tax Chambers.
We do. We have the lovely Catherine Bullock, who's come to chat to us today about property investment companies. Just some general discussion regarding onshore, offshore options, the tax implications, and just a general discussion about what clients might be looking for in those. So good morning, Catherine.
Morning, Catherine.
Morning, Amanda. Morning, Simon.
Okay, over to you.
So Simon, I thought what it might be interesting to talk about this morning was something I'm seeing in practice quite a bit at the moment, which is people who have set up property investment businesses in the past, using an offshore company to hold their UK properties, and who are now wondering, because we've seen so many changes in how land is taxed, whether or not they should bring those companies onshore. And sometimes they own the companies personally, and sometimes they own them through an offshore trust. And I think if the tax position is neutral, then there can be quite a lot of advantages in being able to operate your company onshore. I suppose the most obvious one is costs. There's all the costs of running an offshore company. But also, people like to have control of the company. They like the convenience of being able to exercise that control without having to fly abroad for directors' meetings and be very careful to ensure that the control of their company is happening offshore. And most recently, I've seen some banks saying that they are nervous about providing funding to offshore companies, and they would prefer to provide that funding to UK companies.
Okay.
I think that funding point is quite an interesting one, actually, because I think even for sort of general domestic, if you'd like to buy a property in Germany, or if you'd like to buy a property in the Netherlands or somewhere, I think lenders are really hugely restricting, whereas they used to have international lending and portfolios. I think they've really, that's contracted considerably.
That's,
I think the lending point is a very big one.
I'm seeing that a lot more now, where people are looking to increase their UK property portfolio, whether commercial or residential, and obtaining that borrowing if your company is, you know, in the British Virgin Islands or wherever, it can be more difficult.
And also, even opening a bank account in the UK for a company, if it's held just by a holding company, a very simple structure, the banks are saying, well, we're not going to lend to you. Opening a bank account is difficult. So most of our clients now have gone to Starling Bank or Tide Bank or the High Street Banks and just saying no. So it's very strange.
And you have a similar difficulty with trusts. So, you know, the complexities, I think, particularly if there is no particular tax advantage, you know, can perhaps weigh in that favour of, well, why don't I just bring this all onshore now? And I think if you look through the main taxes, in a lot of scenarios, you know, the tax is now evenly balanced. If you take capital gains tax, for example, it used to be the case that if you were a non-resident individual or a non-resident company, you wouldn't pay capital gains tax on a sale of UK property or the sale of a company that held UK property. But now, effectively as of 2019, it's a level playing field, isn't it? Except for the rebasing. So the fact that if you're an offshore company, you'll only pay capital gains tax from the point at which the law changed. So if it's a commercial land, 6th of April 2019. But it's interesting that in the case of companies, but not individuals, just for companies, if a company becomes UK resident, it doesn't lose that advantage of rebasing. So it still won't have to pay tax on any gains up to 2015 or 2019, depending on whether it's residential or commercial property, which I think is a is an interesting advantage that's sometimes overlooked.
Yes.
And then I guess there's nuances around the anti-avoidance legislation and whether actually if you came onshore, you might even put yourself in a better situation. So capital gains tax, probably neutral or slightly advantageous for a UK structure.
Yep.
I know that you guys have spent a bit of time looking at SDLT already, but you know, I think there's sort of pros and cons there, aren't there? If you're a non-resident company, you've got the 2% non-resident surcharge now if your company is acquisitive. On the other hand, if you decide to sell the shares in your company and it's an offshore company, you might have a 0% rate of stamp duty, particularly if you can execute all of your documents offshore.
Because I advised a couple in Hong Kong, and they were buying a property in Oxfordshire. So of course the 2% higher rate additional ban for the was applicable for the non-residents, but also of course they already own property around the world anyway. So the 2% was also in point. So it's quite expensive.
Yes, I think you know you're looking at a maximum rate of 17%.
Yeah,
massive when you think about it.
And it's so complex, whereas even if you have this situation where you've got a company owned by a family, but say 2% is owned by a daughter, say in Canada, then you have to attribute the 2% to everybody else who's based in the UK. So in effect, it's non-resident company. So it's very complex.
And easily to be caught by those rules. And I think it's a similar position I found with inheritance tax. So if you hold your property through a non-resident company and you're a non-domiciled individual, then that property, because it's wrapped up in an offshore company, is excluded property for inheritance tax purposes, so there's no IHT on it.
Yeah.
Now, we have this change in the rules that say that if that company owns UK residential property and it's controlled by five or fewer people, then we can have a charge for IHT up to the value of that UK residential property in very broad terms. I've been coming across quite a few non-resident trusts who own non-resident companies but don't appreciate deep down within those companies there's pieces of residential UK property. In one situation, it sort of came along with a previous deal. In another, it was a property that had been used for one of the directors to live in when he was in the UK.
Yes.
And so you can have these little charges of inheritance tax that expose you to things like the 10-year charge.
Yep.
Which you wouldn't be expecting ordinarily.
No, it's becoming more complex than it used to be, and it was very complex before. But I think the important thing is a fact find, really. It's to really establish where they're domiciled, which can be difficult, of course. I've got a client at the moment who's lived in Zambia for 17 years. He's a British national originally, and he's going to come back to the UK probably in 2 years' time. So he's got an asset in the UK, a home that we should be okay with the no rate ban. But of course, his main company is in Zambia, along with his other assets. So it's kind of looking at a situation, can we do anything before he arrives back in the UK to try to then pass on his wealth to his son who will stay in Zambia?
Yes. It's really important, isn't it, to understand the actual circumstances and the history of these structures in order to identify the right thing to do and what the planning opportunities actually are.
Yeah.
So where, for example, somebody's got a private trust company, say that they've got based out of Jersey or Guernsey, and they've perhaps done it under one of those jurisdictions for one of the points you made right at the very beginning, is that they want an element of control, which is obviously possible within those jurisdictions. So where they've got property portfolios as well, with effectively onshore residential properties, they're going to get, you know, if they're buying, as you say, if they're buying portfolios that happens to have something residential in the UK, they're going to be caught.
I think that's right. If the trust is an excluded property trust, so it's established by a non-domiciled individual, it's not expected to pay inheritance tax. But like you say, it's acquired a property holding company and that holds properties that have elements of UK residential property, then I think there is a risk that they have an IHT exposure, which if you're an offshore trustee, you may not be expecting. If you're a UK person, you wouldn't expect it either.
Yeah, and I guess that's one of the thinkings is behind doing, you know, entering into private trust companies or being part of that structure is primarily wealth planning.
Yes, so I think it's very careful, very important to be careful.
Yeah,
that these new rules aren't potentially introducing an exposure, and that needs to be managed. Where there is an exposure, there's going to be little benefit in being offshore.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting is that you can move the central management and control of your company to the UK. So you can make your company UK tax resident. But so long as it's a registered company offshore, its share register is kept offshore, it still maintains its offshore status for inheritance tax purposes.
Yeah.
So if your primary driver is to reduce costs or to ensure that you have more control of the company and you're worried about inheritance tax, then there is that possibility to have your company UK tax resident, but remaining as a registered offshore company for other purposes.
Super complex.
Well, I think when you work through it, you know, even things now like, you know, offshore companies and onshore companies are both subject to corporation tax and they both suffer the same rules.
Yeah.
What you generally find is that once you work through the complexities, the playing field has been leveled between offshore companies and UK companies where they are holding property portfolios.
Yeah.
And then the question is, well, would I achieve those other commercial advantages if I brought my company onshore? And then how do I do it? And yeah. how do I do it is interesting, because to change the tax status, so to have the company be tax resident, all we really need to do is bring its central management and control into the UK. What we have then is an offshore company taxed as a UK resident company, and that may be enough. But if, going back to Amanda's point about funding, if it's really important that we are able to say we have a UK company and not a company that is based anywhere else, then you have to go a stage further than that. And in effect, you have to set up a new UK company, move all of the assets, your land, out of the old offshore company, and then liquidate the old offshore company so that all of the property is now in your new UK company. Okay. Because we don't have rules in the UK that allow us to change the domicile of a company from non-resident country to the UK.
Okay. So that's sort of in a sense that you had to form a group, I suppose, in a way, don't you, to then have the UK company being the new holding company, then transfer the assets up, hive it up, or
I think that's right. And you have that difficult dilemma that keeps tax lawyers entertained forever, doesn't it? Do I transfer up or do I transfer down? Which is probably less exciting to
another structure, and of course then okay.
So I think there's sort of almost two stages to that decision. Is it enough for me to have UK tax treatment, or do I actually need a UK company? Or, you know, once you've gone through that analysis.
Yeah. It's a conundrum, isn't it? Because it's more than just going through the steps of looking at there's a tax charge for IHT, look at the advantages from being UK to offshore, then whether you restructure it in some form of UK company, whether you hive up, down, left, right, or centre, depending on the structure of what's already in effect in place, because it could be that you already have maybe an onshore company in the UK, but offshore companies do then have to liquidate and sell them. So yeah,
I think you're making a really important point there, Simon. That lots of these structures are pre-existing; they were set up under old rules. We've had a lot of change over the last 10 years, and what people really need to do is look at the structure now and say, is it fit for purpose? Is it achieving what I want to do with my property business? Is it achieving what I want to do for my personal wealth and my family going forward?
Yeah.
And then I suppose lastly, am I paying the least amount of tax that I can to achieve
this? You also need to really get, you can leave some assets behind in the inheritance structure, which could be still beneficial, but then shift onshore the ones that really are caught by all the new laws.
Yes. And I think that's exactly right. It may be a case of partitioning your assets separately. And what we're talking about here is, you know, is a property investment business.
Yeah.
And often, you know, for various different reasons, that could be combined with the trading business or general investments. I think we've seen that a lot before, haven't we, for business property relief purposes.
Yeah, split it all out. So in a sense, yes, you have to do a demerger, not a high up down, so because more complex.
Yeah, I was going to say as well, in all the sort of moving about from one entity to another, if you're not in the group structure, then you're going to also suffer SDLT charges with the property.
Yes.
Yeah. And if it's a large portfolio, they could be quite considerable.
And of course, if you're in the 3-year clawback period as well, you could have a clawback as well for the SDLT. So, oh, you see, it's supposed to be a nice, easy podcast. It's become a bit numbing now.
I think the main point is that people need to reconsider their old structures given all of the changes, and that tax probably isn't going to be a deal breaker going forward. So, yeah. Figure out what works commercially first.
Yeah. So are you seeing many of these cases for yourself in practice, or?
Yes, a lot, quite a lot at the moment, surprisingly. I'm not entirely sure why that is, except that I think that we've got, you know, some significant movements in the values of UK land at the moment, and it being a prime opportunity perhaps to invest.
And
I guess also with the corporation tax, with these companies coming into charge to corporation tax, it's almost like the last change.
Yeah.
And so it's a good time to take stock. I'm surprised at how many UK resident individuals have inherited these structures. So you would expect, I would expect to be looking at these for, you know, non-resident individuals. But in my circumstances, it tends to be UK resident people whose parents or grandparents set up the structure, and they've sort of inherited the property investment business.
Tend to be advised in a very fragmented way sometimes, because I mean the client we're talking about before we start the podcast, he has a family investment company which he never uses as a FIC. It's just there to own property, completely detached from his main trading entity, which of course will get BPR relief.
Yes.
Therefore, just simply making a simple group in the UK, you can shelter these properties, but they just deal with fragmented advice. They never look at things, in my experience anyway, in a holistic manner. And therefore, they end up with lots of different
bits,
structures that really don't gel together.
I think that's right. And also, don't you find that sometimes there are fashions in things?
Yeah.
So, you know, it will be popular at the moment to have a family investment company.
Yes.
In the past, it was very popular to have an offshore trust, all for various reasons, and, you know, that were very good at that time. But then they linger on, like you say, not particularly being used for anything, but making everything seem a lot more complex than it needs to be.
It gives them the feeling that they're doing something proactive, but they're actually doing nothing apart from incurring costs.
And I think there's a lot of sort of, golf course type advice, isn't there? You know, well, you know, if you put everything offshore, you will save a fortune, and that isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, that's what we call it, the bloke down the pub syndrome.
Yes.
And suddenly get a plug off your client. You've charged me this. Yes, but don't forget we did this also for you as well. Yes, that's true. Yeah,
and I think often the history is lost in the depths of time. So people are worried about doing things. You know, should I get rid of this company? Should I get rid of this trust? Because they don't really know how it was used in the past and whether their actions now could have an impact on something that, you know, happened before, but they're not aware of. As you were saying about domicile status. You know, if you're not sure about whether you're non-domiciled or UK domiciled, it's very hard to know what the right thing to do would be.
Yeah. And like you say, your domicile of origin sticks to you like glue. It's very difficult. If you look at the Richard Burton, who lived in Switzerland for 27 years, but I think in the newspapers he wanted a Welsh flag in his coffin. He was born in Switzerland, but the UK tax said, well, if you're so attached to the UK, we'll tax you in the UK. And he was taxed in the UK.
I think your domicile of choice can be quite sticky as well. I found that recently with people who had a domicile of choice in the UK, domiciled elsewhere, domicile of origin elsewhere, chose to be domiciled in the UK, left the UK to go back to their place of origin, decided that they didn't really like it there and therefore are coming back to the UK again.
Yeah.
And basically, your domicile of choice becomes stickier and stickier because you keep choosing to come back.
Yeah, domicile is, residency is complex anyway, but domicile is I think it's more of a, not a grey area, but it's more difficult to establish because the UK will always want to get their claws into you anyway. And if you're based in, I don't know, Holland, they want their piece before you leave as well. So it's they're trying to slice you into little bits.
Do you think this move towards having the UK tax year aligned with the calendar year will help with all of these decisions?
Oh, I'm not sure.
I just think it'll make Christmas miserable.
I'm not sure, because of course in Spain, of course, you pay your tax in quarterly installments, so it's slightly more advanced, but because they need the money, of course, because of the government. But yeah, it's I don't know.
Absolutely.
Well, that's great. Thank you, Catherine. As always, a pleasure. Always insightful and thoughtful as well going forward. That's very good. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Lovely to join you today.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, and tune in next time when we discuss more of the tax and legal issues surrounding your business and property needs.